So I'll turn it right over to Sean, and I don't know about you, but it's getting warm, so take it away. Well, thanks, Jeremy. Good evening, everyone. The only challenge I guess I have tonight is to get from chapter 29, which is where we'll start, to the end of chapter 37, and also deal with the sciatica that just started to get me. I was landscaping today, working on the side of a gravel bank, shoveling gravel into a wheelbarrow 10 feet up and then wheeling the wheelbarrow. I don't know why I still do this. I'm too old for it, but I'm going to suffer from that tonight. But that's the extent of my suffering. So chapter 29, and I've entitled this class The Trial of Job, and it was entitled, and I apologize for steering you wrong, The God of Job. And really, that's the same thing, because we are going to be talking about God. God is the subject matter of most of these chapters. But in effect, Job is under trial. Job is actually putting God under trial, but now we will see things reversed on him. And if we've been noticing through the book of Job, the terminology of the court of law comes up quite often. Job says in chapter 13 and verse 18, he says, "Behold, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be in the right. Who is there that will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die." Elihu mentions court and trial proceedings and terminology. And he says in chapter 35, "Surely God will not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. How much less when you say that you do not see him, and that case will be brought before him." And that term in the King James, in the Hebrew for case there, means judgment before a tribunal. So that terminology is used by Elihu himself. And the Lord God also speaks in this, and we won't be dealing with chapter 38. That's the subject of next week, when the Lord answers Job out of the whirlwind and says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dressed for action like a man, I will question you and you will make it known to me." So God then becomes in charge of the process of this trial, so that he starts to bring evidence to bear before Job himself. So let's dive right in first by looking at the three questions here that we're going to deal with. And we've been trying to deal with three questions throughout all these classes and never actually get to answer all of them because there's too much material. But first, we're going to look at Job's appeal, and that's chapter 29, 30, and 31. And we're going to find some interesting things about how Job views himself. And then Elihu takes over. And the question I have here is, Elihu the mediator? Is he a judge and mediator before Job, as he prepares, I believe, Job to then present himself before God? And then we'll end the class trying to understand maybe what we can learn about this. So let's get to chapter 29, if we're not there already, and try to look at what is Job's appeal. What's Job's charges before God? Because Job wants to be in a court of law with his God, that he might bring these charges and complaints against him. We're going to have to go through these relatively quickly, but if we start reading in Job 29, and I mentioned right at the start of the series, it's always easier to understand this document if you use a more modern translation. The ESV is primarily what I use, and it's great. Sometimes I've gone to the NIV to clean things up, make it a little bit better, or even some more modern translations, but you have to be very careful with those, because they don't use the words always correctly. But it can help you with the dialogue and help you understand the tense of what they're saying. But basically, in chapter 29, Job is saying, this was then, this was my life before calamity struck and God took everything away from me. My life was blessed, Job is basically saying. And he goes through a number of things and relates those things to those who were within hearing. And we would understand that Job's three friends were still there. Elihu certainly was there, because he relates back to Job all the things that he had heard. We know this is in the presence of God because he hears all. And most likely there were others there as well. So Job's recalling the blessings of his life before all of this suffering started. And certainly it was a glorious life indeed. Verse 2 of chapter 29, "Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head and his light, and in his light I walked through darkness, as I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent. And your version might say various different things to that, but that's the sense of what Job is saying. He starts right off saying, my life was amazing. My life with God there at my side was amazing. He says, I had my children with me then, verse 5, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were all around me. And then he makes this curious statement, when my steps were washed with butter and the rock poured out for me streams of oil. And your version might say, when my cattle was milking, or when my olive trees were plenteous. Some different terminology there. But I think really what it's relating is Job was very prosperous. And everywhere he went, his prosperity was evident. And he found that the glory of his life and the wealth of his abundance and that material substance that we talked about in the first class was evident for all to see. And so he talks about it. How could you not? I mean, you know, I've heard it said, and I'm sure you have before, that for those of us, no matter our station in life in Western Canada, we are all wealthy. In fact, we're in the top 5% of the wealthiest people in the world by population. And so Job is recounting this beautiful life when he was wealthy, when he was successful, when he was healthy. And the world was his oyster, I guess you could say. And Job had a great reputation. And so let's read that, because it seems to me that Job knew he had a great reputation. Verse 7 of chapter 29, and when I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat at the square, the young men saw me and they withdrew. The aged rose and they stood. The princes refrained from talking and laid their hands on their mouths. The voice of the nobles was hushed and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. Now, I've struggled with this particular passage and the things that he says, and there are some commentators who will say that Job was quite arrogant. Now, I'll leave that to you. I don't think I would go that far to say that Job was arrogant about his success and his wealth and his prosperity and his reputation. But I would say this, and that was that Job was a man of influence and respect, and he was quite aware of it. He was quite aware of how people reacted to him. And if you read through chapter 29 and chapter 30, you'll realize the subject matter of those two chapters is fundamentally about his reputation, about what other people thought of him or how other people saw him. And I do find that a little curious. So that's why I say it's kind of difficult to think about. Is Job just being factual and saying, look, this is how my life was. It was amazing. And these are all the things that I did, and people saw it, and they were very respectful of it. Or was it a little bit more than that? Now, it says in verse 14, it says, I put on righteousness. Now, your version might say justice. And it clothed me, it says. And my justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. Now, that word there for righteousness, and I started to do a study on the word righteousness in the book of Job. Take a guess how many times the word righteousness or the derivatives of that word, which could be justice or just or being just, but they're all fundamentally the same sense in the Hebrew. How many times it comes up in the book of Job? You and I have already talked about this. 47 times. So when we were talking a couple of classes ago about the righteousness of Job, and I was trying to make the point that Job believed in his own righteousness, Job actually talks a lot about his own righteousness. It comes up here again, that he knew him to be just. He knew the things that he did were righteous. And so he brings it up here again. So clearly this is a man that saw his life as blessed, materially and spiritually. He saw God's hand in his life, but I would submit somewhat mechanically, because the word love only comes up once in the entire book. Kindness, never. Mercy, never. And, you know, I did a word cloud. I think I mentioned this in the third class, and I found it very informing about the words that are used and the words that are not used. And maybe if we have a chance, we'll throw it up on the screen after. It's very interesting. The book of Job is fundamentally dark in nature. It's negative in its tense. In fact, the words for wickedness and darkness come up over 60 times. Job had a preoccupation with his suffering and the darkness that he was now under. And keep in mind, he's under darkness for the better part of the book of Job, the record that we have. Job is a man that has been humbled, and he is aware of his success and of his righteousness and of his reputation and of his legacy. And now here he's mourning the loss of it. We can, I think, maybe get like this sometimes, brothers and sisters, that we can see our lives going well. And as I said a little bit earlier, we're fundamentally very wealthy in this community relative to the other 8 billion people on this earth. And by the way, not sure if you're keeping track, but they say that we're going to hit 8 billion people on this earth sometime around November of this year. But I believe in the sense of what Job is talking about, that he expected this blessing. He expected his blessing to continue. And that's why he's so confused at why it is gone. And I think that's an issue that we all have. The blessings that we've been given by God, we have them long enough. We think that they're there by our own ingenuity or the strength of our own hand or the wit of our wisdom. Yet they've been given to us by God. And so we can't let, brothers and sisters, the blessings of our life be anything more than that. They're not the result of anything that we have done necessarily, but they are a gift from God. You know, Job, right at the start in chapter 1 and chapter 2, when his suffering has completed, and he makes those two statements, and the one of them is in Job 1, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. Shall we receive good from God and not receive evil in chapter 2? Those were statements that he made before he has spent now probably weeks, a number of weeks, considering the length and the duration of his suffering. And so it's not uncommon that we suffer too, brethren and sisters. And initially, maybe we can handle it. But even over time, as we see the trial continue, we start to ask those questions about the fairness of it all. Surely I've learned my lesson. Let's move on. And we start to challenge God as Job has done. Verse 18 of Job 29, just read this from the NIV. Job says, I thought I would die in my own house, and my days would be as numerous as the grains of sand, and my roots would reach to the water, and the dew would lie all night on my branches. Job felt his life would continue to be amazing until the day that he died at a good old age with a huge family and a massive empire and the respect of his peers and a legacy that would last for generations. And ironically, his legacy has lasted because we're talking about him tonight. Thankfully, we'll also get to talk to him in the kingdom, and we can maybe challenge him on the things that he understood. So if chapter 29 is the fond memories of a very recent, wealthy, healthy, amazing, glorious life, then chapter 30 must in fact be the darkness of Job's current near-death reality. And I do apologize that I didn't put the second part of this up here, but I think you get the sense of it all, right? That he was praised for his goodness. He said, I was righteous and I did good things and I helped the weak and I was a leader and a king. And when I spoke, people listened. And this was certainly how Job saw his life. Let's just make sure these all get up here. So now chapter 30, things change dramatically because now he's talking about his life as it is now. My life, he says, is ruined. Verse 1 of chapter 30, but now they mock me, men younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to put with my sheepdogs. And what he's basically saying is like, there's people I would never even have hired, and they mock me. So now we start to understand what really Job thought of himself and what he thought others thought of him. Verse 9, and now I've become their song. I've become a byword to them. And so he's actually quite nasty to the people that he really felt were less than worthy of his company and his presence. But now they're the ones that mock him. And surely that's a massive change for a man like Job to see his reputation and his legacy be completely destroyed. Verse 15, I'm overcome with terror. My dignity is gone like a puff of wind and my prosperity like a cloud. Now I am about to die and there's no relief for my suffering. So this dramatic reversal a fortune. And yes, Job is in pain. He's still mourning his loss. And so it's not that we don't understand his suffering in the sense that he was definitely under trial. But as I said before, what you see in this chapter that he talks about mostly is the loss of favor and the loss of respect and the loss of position, and how he now sees those that are less than him see themselves as greater than Job. And of course, he mentions quite often that God doesn't listen to him. And this is certainly one of his charges. Verse 20, I call to you, O God, but you never answer. And when I pray, you pay no attention. And you are treating me cruelly. You persecute me with all of your power, he says. And Job believes he's going to die. And he believes that God is pushing him there, although he understands that everybody ultimately does die. He says in verse 23, I know you are taking me off to my death, to the fate that is in store for everyone, he says. Have I not wept for those that are in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? Yet when I hoped for good, evil came, and when I looked for light, then came darkness. The churning inside me never stops. The days of suffering confront me. And so this is a tragic thing, and Job is just churning out all of this misery as he talks his way through the issues that he has and the charges that he has before God. It's not that often that we hear this type of language in the Word of God, and it's not very often that we ever have a Bible school or a Bible class series on the Book of Lamentations. It doesn't come up that often because Lamentations is very dark. It's very depressing. You'll find this type of language all through the Book of Lamentations. So Job's life, once full of light and song, has now gone dark, verse 31, where I once heard joyful music, now I hear only mourning and weeping. And he feels as if his God has literally failed him. That all of the things that God has been, or Job has been recounting to his God and crying out and mourning and asking for an audience and attendance, he feels that God is silent. And I can feel for Job. I think we can all feel for Job. You know, we'd be very cold and very emotionless if we didn't understand at some level, if we didn't sympathize, maybe even empathize with where Job is at. You know, it's not that he's lost everything. Job is actually in deficit. He's gone into the negatives. If we were to use some kind of a numerical evaluation, he's way worse off than he ever was. God didn't just bring him down to zero. God brought Job into deficit. And there's certainly a reason for that, and we're going to find out when Elihu starts to speak that for some of us, suffering brings about repentance very quickly. It brings about realization very quickly. It can bring about change in our lives very quickly. And I'm not saying that it works exactly like that, that God does something and we learn and we move on. I'm not saying that, but certainly with Job, his issue was that as long as his trial was and as difficult as his suffering was, Job at this point is still not at a point where he understands it or he knows what's happening. He can only cry foul. And so he brings his final appeal to God in chapter 31. Remind me to take out all of these silly animations. Chapter 31, this final appeal, which is kind of to sum up and say that Job is saying, well, but am I not righteous? And then he recounts all the things that he has done. Right in verse 1, I made a covenant with mine eyes, not to look upon a maid. Doesn't God see this? Verse 4. Where did I go wrong, he says in verse 5. I'm righteous. He racks his mind to try to think of anything that he's done that is grievous enough to have caused this kind of suffering. And in his mind, he finds nothing. I haven't done anything wrong. Look at the things that I actually have done. I've always been fair and just. verse 13. I've helped others, he says in verse 16. I've never trusted in riches, he says in verse 24. I'm not an idolater, he says in verse 26. I didn't even wish harm on my enemies, he says over the next few verses. I opened my house to strangers. I did all of these things. I am righteous, Job says. I stand up for truth. And so he's bringing this defense to his God. Verse 35 says, oh, that I had someone that could hear me and sign now my defense. He's talking about just bring it to me in writing. If somebody's got charges against me, bring it in writing. I'll put it up on my shoulders and I will proudly carry it about because I know that it's not true. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put this indictment in writing. Surely I would wear it upon my shoulder. I would put it on like a crown. I would give him account of my every step. I would present it to him as if a ruler. And it says the words of Job are ended. I rest my case. I brought before my Creator all the evidence of my good life. I've told you all the complaints of this, the terrible unfairness of my suffering, and you are silent. God has given me no answer. And sometimes we reflect on our lives, brothers and sisters. We see the good that we've done, and we calculate the good that we've done. And you might think, oh, I don't do that. But we all do it. We all add the things up, all the stuff that I've done in the back of our mind. We use a very human kind of math on a calculator of our own making. We punch out the numbers, and sometimes when we suffer, we don't get that job, or things don't work out, or we don't have enough money, or we didn't get that house, or, you know, we're just not feeling that healthy, or whatever it is. We say, that's unfair. Maybe God is wrong to not give me that. And maybe I'm right. And Job certainly had a lot more evidence to bring to bear of the goodness that he has done, and a lot more evidence of the suffering that he was being committed to. And even in the depths of his suffering, Job held on to his righteousness. Chapter 27 and 6, I will not let it go, he says. I will not let my righteousness go. And so even in the resting of his case before God, and he had offered ample human evidence, certainly his life was very good. Job has done way more, I think, than any of us have ever done in our lives. And that's the point of the extreme example of Job. And he has suffered more than any of us will ever suffer. That is also the point of the record of Job. Brothers and sisters, we live in a world that is unfair. But sadly, if we stopped and looked at what's happening out there, society's moving into this point where everybody thinks that they deserve every goodness in this world and everything that it has to offer. That there's no one like us. We're unique in all the world. 8 billion unique people, very unique and special, and we deserve the best that the world has to offer. But the sad reality is life is not fair. And Job is experiencing the natural and the spiritual unfairness of his life. Turn over to 1 Timothy 6 and 6. Because although we can be a good person and we can do wonderful things in our lives, do we dare challenge God and expect then treatment beyond what we deserve? Or cry foul when things don't go our way? Do we ever challenge God to do better in our lives? Like somehow we've earned it and we deserve to keep the things that we've been blessed to have. I don't think so. 1 Timothy 6 and 6 says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world and we cannot take anything out of this world. The words of Job. But if we have food and clothing, with these we ought to be content. For those who desire to be rich will fall into temptation, to a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. And the question I have is, brothers and sisters, do we thank God for the things that we have? Put up your hand if you thank God for the things that you have. Okay, most everyone. Do we ever thank God for the things we've never been given? Put up your hand if you thank God for the things you've never been given. Because they may be a temptation in your life. They may become a problem for you. So it's maybe two of you. Do we ever thank God for the trial he puts us under? It's something that I never do. Do we ever thank God for the trial he puts us under? Surely knowing, brothers and sisters, that is for our good. Well, I would say shame on us if we don't, and we'd better get at it. But that's definitely the issue that Job has. So let's move on to a summation of what were the charges of Job. And he had many, and I distilled them down to really these two with some subheadings so that we kind of understand where those came from. Job had a lot of issues, and that document that I handed out a couple weeks before we started this actually has probably as many as 20 different issues that Job had. But really, these are the ones that I think are important because these are the ones that are going to be dealt with in the subsequent chapters. Number one, Job's major charge was that God is a poor ruler of the world. And he says that because Job believes that God's creation and the things that God does and how he acts with his creation is arbitrary and destructive. Now, those aren't the only verses there that prove that point. There's probably four or five from the book of Job. So we just don't have time to go through all those. Number two, that God is a poor ruler of the world because he lets the wicked prosper. Because Job looks around and just sees people prospering. And that he lets the righteous suffer because Job looks at himself and says, I'm righteous and I'm suffering. So therefore, God is a poor ruler of the world. And the third thing is, and it came out in those chapters we just read, is that God doesn't communicate with Job. That God either is unwilling to or cannot relate to man. And both of those charges are levied by Job because he talks about God's ultimate righteousness and goodness being an obstacle to communication with man, but also that God is just refusing to deal with Job's situation. And the second charge that Job has is related, but specifically here different, because it's dealt with differently, is that God is unjust and cruel. He's just simply cruel. And the two charges, sub-charges that Job brings, of course, is that Job himself is suffering, as he sees it, unfairly and for no reason at all, no explanation. And number two, that Job believes his righteousness should count for something. And he feels like it doesn't. And doesn't that come out in chapters 29, 30, and 31? As Job's trying to put together evidence to say, look at the good things that I've done, and yet over here is this suffering and destruction you brought upon me. Surely, God, this is worth more than what you've given me. So those are the 2/5 things that Job brings to bear throughout the record of Job and the things that he has spoken about. Specifically, he brought them up again in those three chapters. So, what do you think so far? Any questions? Feedback, comments? Confusion. Brother Mike.
I haven't fully articulated this slide, but you get to look at some, I was just looking at some of the more complete context around some of these. Whether the conclusion that you summarized is God's approval ruler. So I'd be interested in taking that a little bit further.
Sorry, the conclusion is?
Well, I know you tried to distill this into a couple of main conclusions. But I was just looking at, I only got as far as number one there.
Okay. Well.
But anyways, yeah, if you get to take a look at that, maybe you'd like to take a look at that afterwards. Yeah, a couple of thoughts.
Yeah, no, good comment. I think, you know, part of where this comes from is when you read the earlier chapters and you see the things that Job clearly has an issue with and repeats over and over again. And we talked in the early chapters about the issue of exact retribution, and I haven't really made a big deal about it because I'm not really sure that's the context of the book of Job. God certainly deals with it. His friends had that wrong. Job initially believed that when you did good, you were blessed, and when you did evil, you were cursed. And we talked a little bit about there being evidence in the Old Testament that that's kind of how things were generally, but not specifically with how God works. But Job progressed away from that. And Job, by the time we get to Job here in his appeal, I don't believe believes that anymore. The interesting thing is what God says to the three friends at the end of the book, that he said, if you don't listen to Job and allow him to mediate for you, then I'll make you suffer according to your own folly. And I think that point that God is making probably is that if you really don't get this, then I will treat you with exact retribution. I think it's an interesting thing to think about. The other reason why I've got this list here is because of what Elihu says. And there's a lot of discussion, you know, back and forth about what did the three friends say? Was it truth? Was it not truth? Most of what the three friends said is just not scripturally correct. Although they do say certain things like God is wise and God is all powerful that we would know to be generally true. And we went through those points of what was specifically false, even though it might be generally true. In this case, when Elihu starts to bring the evidence to bear with Job, he deals with each and every one of these particular issues. And then the beautiful part of this is, and this is just my feeling, my belief, and I'll submit this to you, is that Elihu prepares Job to meet his God. And then God actually deals with these particular charges, starting in chapter 38 and 39, and then for the rest of the book. Jeremy.
I think there's a nuance that your slides aren't conveying. And if you ask Job, is God a poor ruler of the world? He said no. Or, you know, is God arbitrary and destructive? He said no. And so what I think the difference is what we're more often guilty of, which is the implications of the things we say actually do make those statements. So it's what are Job's charges implying is really what it is. And if you could just get past his own hurdle, he'd realize, oh, what I just said was wrong.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And the reason I've termed it this way is because Job, under suffering, believes that God is a poor ruler of the world. Job, when his life was amazing, would have said, no, I think God is awesome because look what he's given me. And I think that's part of what comes out of the book is not so much that we suffer, but how we respond to the suffering. And clearly Job's responding very poorly because he still doesn't understand things. So I'm not saying I'm agreeing or disagreeing with your comment, but the way I see it is kind of like Job, you know, pre-suffering and post-suffering is two different Jobs in the sense that when he was recounting his life in verse 29, he was very positive about his relationship with God, although very limited in his description. But certainly the things that he says and how he cries out, cries foul and continues to say, isn't my righteousness worth something? I think he feels that I believe God should be a poor ruler of the world, but because I'm suffering, I feel that he isn't, at least as it relates to me. And I think that's kind of the thing I'm trying to wrestle through in my head. I don't know if that answers your question or at least explains anything, but that's just how I see it.
That is correct. Like, yeah. When we're in the dumps, we'll say things the way we feel them.
Yeah.
Rather than the way we know them.
That's right. And I think that's Job's issue. And I believe, hopefully it comes out, is how Elihu presents them. And I think what we see in the transition of Job kind of starting with Elihu's commentary, although the text doesn't tell us, and Job continued to learn, or and Job said, yes, that makes sense, is that we have this complete breakdown of Job and his repentance before God. Steve?
So what I'm struggling with, say, but with the language that he's used. And is it that his creation feels that he's arbitrary and destructive? So that's my problem, is that is what God is doing arbitrary and destructive? Because what that says to me is that he just created arbitrarily and destructive. And I'm not sure that I understand that in the context of him being a poor ruler of the world, because I think Job actually did see God as being that's where I was.
Yeah, we can maybe look at some of the verses after that come up earlier in the sense that I get from the way Job talks is that essentially God uses his creation to grind people to powder because he doesn't understand the complexity of it. And I think that's the beauty of what God does when he inserts himself in chapter 38 and 39 is he presents to Job the mind-blowing complexity of creation because Job doesn't understand it. I think Job looks at creation very simplistically, like, hey, if it's raining on me, then things might be good. And if it's not raining on me, then it isn't. But we can look at some of the verses. I presented some of those earlier on, and they are in that document that you can kind of look at. And the sense that I get is he just felt that the way God worked with him because he was suffering, because everything is from the context of his suffering, right? He looks out, he sees the wicked prospering. Well, that doesn't make any sense. And then God must be destructive and cruel because I'm being punished and yet I've done all this good stuff. So I think it's part of that sort of, you know, pre and post suffering Job that we get at. But we can definitely look at some of those verses, but that's a great comment. Thanks. Maybe need to elucidate that a little bit more. All right, let's move on to Elihu. And so is Elihu the mediator? And I'll answer what I think, I believe from my understanding of the text is that Elihu is the mediator. He's actually the judge. He brings a lot to bear to Job in the condemnation of what Elihu believed were Job's incorrect understanding of things, and certainly of his God, but that Elihu was preparing Job, softening him up, so to speak, so that when he finally came to God, Job was already at that point where he was starting to understand that he was wrong. Because I think if Job went from chapter 31 straight to standing before God, he may have completely missed God's point. And so I think Elihu is inserted into this process. God inserts Elihu into this process to help Job start to understand the things that he did not. And let's just look at some of those things, because Elihu almost systematically deals with each of Job's issues. So starting in chapter 32, and maybe we can go through this quickly because this is less important to the context of what we're talking about, is how Elihu intervenes. So he's, just very quickly, he's the youngest of all the friends. And, you know, traditionally and culturally in those days, and I suppose to a certain degree, maybe some of that's left today, maybe not, is that the younger waits and allows the elder to speak. And so that's what Elihu did. And essentially what he's saying is, I'm bursting to say something because I literally cannot believe what you guys are talking about. It's just in Elihu's mind is so wrong, and he had to just get it out. And we see that in the first few verses of chapter 34, verse 4. Now Elihu had waited before speaking to Job because they were elder than him. And he says in verse 13, how can you claim to have discovered wisdom? God must answer Job, for you have failed. Elihu's talking to the three friends. So the three friends were of no hope and no help for Job himself. And it says there in verse 19, if I don't get a chance to speak, and this is from the NIV, I'll burst like a wineskin full of new wine. So we can understand the urgency with which Elihu believed he needed to bring to bear this information to Job. I'm going to come back to this, but effectively, Elihu summarizes Job's issues. So if you read verse 8 to 13, Elihu's basically saying, Job, let me just understand what you're saying. Number one, you say you're righteous, and you certainly haven't committed a sin worthy of all the suffering. Number two, you say God is cruel and is attacking you and treating you like the enemy. Number three, that God doesn't communicate with you. And that comes out in those few verses there. And so that's the question in verse 23 when Elihu states, if there were to be for him, Job, I think specifically here, an angel or a mediator or an intercessor, that term, one in a thousand to declare to man or this man in particular what is right, that maybe this is Elihu inserting himself in. I'm not saying Elihu's saying, I'm your mediator. I'm saying, Job, what you need is a mediator to help you understand these things. But I think that's exactly what Elihu was, this man in a thousand. And certainly there's messianic, terms here that we can look to for Christ. And we look at Job as the intercessor and the mediator. And we'll look at in the last class some of the terminology that's used in Job, where the term for intercessor and mediator is actually used. It comes up quite often as the word pray, and that word pray, at least in this sense, is interchangeable with the term intercessor, but it does come up, and it's quite interesting, certainly used of Job for his friends in chapter 42. So let's take a look at how Elihu breaks this down. First of all, he says in chapter 33, by the way, Job, God does communicate. We're not treating them in the same order that Job relates them. We're treating them in the order that Elihu brings them to bear. So verse 15 to 18, Elihu says, Job, here's the ways that God does communicate. Number one, Job communicates in dream and vision. Verse 15, in a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls upon men while they slumber in their beds. This is one way that God communicates with people. And we know that if we looked up the verses relative to the prophets or those faithful men and women, that God does communicate in that way. We only have to think of Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Daniel to know that that is true. Number two, Elihu says, by the way, Job, in case you didn't understand this, God communicates by chastening. And he says that in verse 19 to 22. Man is also rebuked with pain on his bed and with continual strife in his bones, so that his life loathes bread and his appetite the choicest food. Is this not Job? And Elihu's saying, you're not listening. Now, maybe God didn't speak to you in vision or dream, or maybe you didn't hear it or discern it, but certainly he's communicating with you through this process, Job. And number three, God communicates by a mediator. And again, it's not, there's no time in this class to deal with the mediatorship or the intercessor that God has always given to the faithful. But here Elihu tells Job that that's the case. When a man prays to God and he accepts him and sees his face with a shout of joy and he restores this man to his righteousness. Verse 28 talks about redemption. So Elihu's just recounting to Job, you say God doesn't communicate. Well, you know what? You're wrong. You are incorrect. Because as far as Elihu understands, God does communicate. And here's three specific ways that he does. And I put up there 3 + 1 because kind of the fourth one is kind of a negative, because Elihu says, but just one thing, Job. God doesn't communicate with those that are prideful. Verse 22 of chapter 36, he says, behold, God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? But there, though they cry out, but he does not answer because of the pride of men. So, and that comes up in subsequent chapters, but Elihu is basically saying, here's the ways that God communicates if you choose to listen. And God may not communicate with you if your problem is pride. And I think we can be pretty sure that that was one of Job's issues. And so I think it's beautiful the way Elihu brings this out, that here are all the different ways that God does communicate. 2 Samuel 7 and 14, dealing with chastening, I will be to him a father and he shall be to me a son. And when he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men and the stripes of the son of men. And surely this is talking about David, but also the future Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. And then the issue of the mediatorship is just beautiful. That verse there in 24, it says, but he is merciful to him and says, deliver him from going down into the pit, for I have found a ransom. Let his flesh become the flesh of youth. Let him return to the days of his youthful vigor. When man prays to God and he accepts him, and that word pray there is the intercessor, and sees his face with a shout of joy and restores a man to his righteousness. And so it's just, I think, a beautiful way that Elihu is trying to recount to Job that through the stubbornness of his heart, or the prideful barrier that he'd put up, or the fact that he was focusing on the wrong things or being confused about why things are happening, Elihu says, actually, you might be missing all the communication that God is using to try to reach you. God does communicate, but oftentimes we're not listening. He communicates to us in all kinds of ways, brothers and sisters. He communicates to us through his word. He communicates us through prophecy. He communicates to us through his creation, the witness, the very fact that God is evident in everything that we see. We were talking just the other night with the kids about the new Webb telescope. You guys heard heard any of the articles or seen any of the photographs of the new Webb telescope? Ian, how much did it cost? Was it $10 billion? So there was the Hubble telescope. Before that, there was the other telescope. And each telescope is like a factor of 10 better or something. The Webb telescope is bringing back, if you haven't seen any photographs, as soon as you get home, just Google NASA Webb telescope photographs. It to me, is the evidence of a creator. The photographs are just, they're stunning. You can't even explain how beautiful and mysterious that they are. They're taking photographs of things that are billions of light years away, and they're just colorful and beautiful, and there's stars exploding, and there's all this stuff going on. And I think that's what we're going to see when we get to chapter 38, is God presents to Job just the magnitude, the colossal magnitude of his creation has got to be one of those ways that he communicates with us. But he also communicates, brothers and sisters, by chastening and by suffering. And I think in this case, God communicated to Job by all three of these methods. But Job wasn't listening. Behold, who is a teacher like God, exalted in his power? And so this chapter in particular closes with a challenge from Elihu to Job. And he says, if not, listen to me, then be silent, he says to Job, and I will teach you wisdom. And he goes on in this next chapter to deal with the next series of issues that Job has. And Elihu says to Job, God is just. So he's already dealt with God does communicate. Now he says, God is just. And by the way, he does punish the wicked, but here's the caveat. He may not do it in the way that you think. And so Elihu reviews Job's complaints, verses 5 and 6, right? He's saying things, he's recounting things that Job says. And sometimes you don't see some of the things that Elihu says, and this is maybe what causes a bit of concern. Elihu will say something, you'll look in the previous chapters of Job, and you can't find where Job actually said that. I think we have to understand that there was a lot of commentary that is not recorded. It's either that or Elihu's incorrect, but the sense of what he says is relevant because Job has said similar things already. So I think the way I look at it is Elihu's saying, here's, if I understand you right, Job, here's what I think you're saying. I'm in the right, and God has taken away my right, verse 5. In spite of my right, I am counted a liar. My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. So Elihu spends a few verses there just retelling back to Job how he thought he heard Job. So just so I'm clear, you say you're righteous, maybe not without sin, but certainly not in a position to be suffering like this. And so that's why you say that God is unjust. And I'm just putting words in Elihu's mouth. And then Elihu states that God is just and he judges the wicked. We'll have to read. You can read the rest of the verses, but just pointing out in verse 11 there, for according to the work of man, he will repay him. According to his ways, he will make it befall him. And really, everyone should die. But fundamentally, Job, you have to understand that the way you see things is not necessarily how God does things, because your vision is very limited. It's very myopic. You don't see everything that's happening all around the world. All you're looking at is your own issue. And you say you're righteous and you're suffering. So you go, okay, well, God's wrong with that. And maybe you've seen a couple other wicked people prosper, and that's how you've made your judgment. I think Elihu's saying, you need to understand the full context of how God works around the world with everyone. And verse 16 to 20, God is just, and he's impartial. He's not like us. He doesn't operate like that, Job. And God sees and knows everything, verse 21 and on. Nothing escapes him. He just may not work within your time frame. God doesn't work like you think with exact retribution, that if somebody does wrong, that suddenly they should be punished. And that was one of the confusions that Job had. Elihu challenges then Job right at the end of that chapter to confess his sins and try to understand his God better. And we see that in the last few verses, 31 to 33. And sorry, I'm just trying to get through these few verses. And then he says something that I think is very beautiful as well, that sometimes Elihu says to Job, God's silence is intended. You know, because I think if we think of God in the continuum of eternity, and then our just minuscule little few years on the earth, and we expect God to work at our speed, and God is working at an eternal speed, doing things that have eternal outcomes. God is was working on things 5,000 years ago that won't be manifested till the kingdom, and that's a time scale that we don't understand. But yet we expect God to work in our time frame, and that's, I think, one of Job's issues. Your wickedness, it says in verse 8, concerns a man like yourself, and your righteousness, a son of man. So you focus too much on yourself, Job, and the things that are happening. Because of the multitude of oppressions, people cry out. They call for help because of the arm of the mighty. But none says, where is God my maker who gives songs in the night? And I think what Elihu's saying is, we only have an issue with God when there's a problem. And we don't give praise to God because of all the good things he does. And I think that's the sense of what Elihu's saying. It's like Job, like, you didn't give God praise when things were going great. But now that things are going wrong, suddenly God is creating all these issues. But none says, where is God my maker who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens? Because Job doesn't say anything like that. Verse 12, where they cry out, but he does not answer because of the pride of evil men. And we've already quoted this previously in a previous slide. Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. How much less when you say that you do not see him, that the case is before him and you're waiting for him. So Elihu just basically exposes Job and his empty cry. How much less when you say you do not see him and that the case is before him and you're waiting for him. And so he's saying, you know, Job, you are really approaching this whole thing wrong. Your expectations are wildly out of context. And your charges against God are just patently unfair. We would say today, unscriptural. And sometimes God waits in silence until we get our heads right and approach him in humility. And Job was at this point just beginning to understand that he needed to be humble. And then Job answers probably his biggest question, which is, okay, let me tell you, Job, this is why you're suffering. I think this is, to me, the turnaround section of the entire book of Job. I think this is very, very powerful because this is exactly how God operates with us. Number one, he says in chapter 36, starting at verse 5, God absolutely knows how to deal with man. We may not think that God is dealing with us and our special needs and the things that we require. But God has a process, and he knows us better than we know ourselves. And for those, Elihu says, that are really afflicted, like you, Job, he's actually working with you through that affliction. Remember, he's already told him about how God is communicating with him through his affliction. Verse 8, and if they are bound in chains and caught in the cords of affliction, then he declares to them their work and their transgressions, that they are behaving arrogantly. That's a term from a modern translation. But he's kind of getting pretty harsh with Job because Job is still, you know, got this barrier up. I mean, God dismantled him with his suffering, but now Elihu has to dismantle his prideful defense. What is important, Elihu's saying, is not that we suffer, Job, but how we respond to that suffering. Look what he says in verse 11. But if they listen and serve him, so these are people that God is chastising. If they listen and serve him, they complete their days in prosperity and their years in pleasantness. He delivers them by their affliction and opens their ear through adversity. So to me, this is very clear. Elihu's saying, Job, the very reason why you are suffering is because God is trying to communicate with you and open your heart and open your mind to his understanding. And if you just let him do that, he will deliver you by your affliction. You're resisting, Job, you're resisting God's spiritual process in your life. And you're closing your ears. But yet God is trying to communicate with you. And I think this is very beautiful. 1 Corinthians 11 and 32, and we know this verse. And when we are judged, we are chastened of the Lord, that we should not be condemned with the world. And so even though we might cry foul and unfairness in the things that God is doing in our minuscule, you know, little life, what God is actually doing is bringing about a divine outcome. And it's us that struggles against it. God's trying to bring a divine outcome to Job, and he's resisting it. Elihu's stating to Job, you complain about your suffering, but it's because God is working with you. It's like the verse that says, God chastises those whom he loves. And it's like Job, you know, is resisting the love of God. Job has been behaving with pride and with arrogance, according to Elihu. God was dismantling him so that he might listen, he might remove all of the barriers and know that there is this grievous character flaw that Job needed to fix, that God needed to fix in Job. We all have a grievous character flaw, and that is our human nature and our pride and the arrogance of our nature. And the extension of his suffering was because I think Job was so stubborn that he didn't realize or he couldn't accept the things that are happening to him. And it took Elihu to just enlighten him on that fact. Job, you just keep saying this is unfair. But what I'm telling you is, Job, God is actually working in your life. The question that you should ask Job is not why me, but what do you want me to do now? And then he reminds Job that he's such a great teacher. We've already quoted a few of these verses. Remember, how great is God's power? He is the greatest teacher of all. Sometimes we don't see it, or we don't want to see it, or we deny that it's there, or we pretend because maybe sometimes we don't want to change, or we don't want to accept the fact that we're not the way God wants us to be, right? And that's a tragic flaw of many churches in this world is they preach that God will accept you the way you are, and you're perfect the way you are, and don't worry, God's got you. But God will accept us the way we are, but then he requires us to change. It's the accepting that we find easy. It's the change that we find very, very difficult. And that's the sad reality of the world that we have today. It's not about what is right before God. It perhaps never was, really, but less so now than I think at any time, probably in human history. God has a plan for this earth. He actually has a plan for each and every one of us. And I mentioned, I think, in class one that I think it's very beautiful if we stop to reflect that this whole process that we have in 42 chapters in the record of Job and all the dialogue and all the different characters and all the things that happen and all the suffering and the process that God brings Job through is actually a personal one-on-one training session that God has with Job. And God will do that for us too. I think that's one of the lessons that we can learn. God has a plan for this earth. He has a plan for us. He has a plan for any of us that are willing to endure his chastening, to allow ourselves to be perfected in our characters, that we might let God instill in us the mind of Christ. And I think, brethren and sisters, that we should pray every single day that we'd be willing to accept those things in our lives. I mean, we have such an incredible hope that we should never put up a wall like Job did, that he might, you know, stand as it were on Solomon's porch and proclaim his righteousness, that somehow that was worthy to God. We are not worthy of the kingdom on the basis of our righteousness. We're only accepted by God if we let him break us down and strip away the arrogance, the pride, the self-will, and accept God into our lives so that he might change us into something that's worthy of his love. And I don't think that Job did get there, but I don't think that Job could have got there without the mediatorship of Elihu. Without Elihu being his intercessor. to prepare Job's mind and to bring him off his own pedestal so that he might then listen to God, the greatest teacher that there is. And it's the same with us, of course. We cannot get there to a place that we would be remotely acceptable to God without our intercessor, the Lord Jesus Christ. And so we go through the same process that Job does. We have to go through the same process as Job does. And some of us more and some of us less. And that's really inconsequential. But for Job, his trial is not over because for the stubbornness of his heart and maybe the arrogance, his thoughts about himself, God saw fit that there would be no still small voice. There'd be no sound of marching in the myrtle trees as there was for David. What Job needed was a storm that would captivate his attention and bring to bear on this man the power and the might of his creator. And so as Elihu is speaking here in these next few chapters, he starts to talk about the storm that is gathering over top of all of them. It says in chapter 37, the last chapter that Elihu speaks, it says, "At this also my heart trembles and leaps out of its place. Keep listening, Job, to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. Under the whole heaven he lets it go and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it his voice roars, he thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice." Elihu says he does great things that we cannot comprehend. And so we have to think that wherever they were in that place, so there's Job suffering with a broken piece of a potsherd, still scraping his boils. His three friends now sitting there silenced because they could not help him. And Elihu, this youngest friend now, interceding for Job. I don't know why this is making me emotional, but it is. He says in verse 23, "The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, and abundant righteousness that he will not violate." And I guess maybe to Jeremy's point is that one of the things, and I removed the slide, and maybe I apologize for doing so, of the things that Job got right about his God. And there were a number of things that Job got right. He understood certain aspects of God's character, and he got those right. He knew that God was wise and that God was all powerful. And he believed in his heart, Job did, that God's righteousness would ultimately prevail on him. That Job believed, even though he approached it in the wrong way, that God was too righteous to not let Job speak his case, and that God was too righteous to not allow Job a mediator. Therefore, verse 24, "Men fear him, and he does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit." And I think that is intended to Job. But Elihu is still trying to say in these final words that he's trying to intercede for Job and tell him, "Job, you've got to come down off that pedestal because this storm that is brewing could go either way. It could have ultimately destroyed Job, or it could have brought about his redemption." So what can we learn just in the last few minutes here? That, brothers and sisters, we may suffer in this life. We do suffer in this life. We might feel justified sometimes in thinking that it's unfair, and maybe in some worldly sense it is. But we must trust in God. We must trust in his mercy. We must trust that he has the right outcome for each and every one of us, and not rage against him and cry foul and unfair. Proverbs 19:3 says, "When a man's folly brings his way to ruin, his heart rages against the Lord." And I think we see that coming out in Job, and thankfully, Job turns the corner as God starts to speak. We can't think of that everything that that we have is ours to keep, and that God's blessings are in fact from our own hard work. And even in those times, brethren and sisters, of maybe utter darkness in our lives, when we think that God is not listening, He is. And when we think that God is not communicating to us, that He is. But we might be too wrapped up in our own lives to listen. And so if there's one lesson that comes out of this class, brethren and sisters, it is that we need to be always listening for the voice of God and willing to understand His purpose in our lives. Psalm 37 and 7, it says, "Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil, for evildoers shall be cut off, but those that wait upon the Lord, they shall inherit the earth." And so, God willing, next week, we'll deal with the restoration of Job, which begins with the storm that breaks over top of Job as God begins to speak. Thanks.